Good evening and welcome to Tuesday's Late Debate. It's great to be back. Joining us tonight, we have Lisa Chambers, Fianna Fáil Senator and Spokesperson on Foreign Affairs and European Affairs, Claire Curran, Sinn Féin TD for Roscommon Galway, Breed Smith, People Before Profit TD for Dublin South Central, John Downing, Political Correspondent with the Irish Independent, and Kevin Cunningham, pollster and lecturer in politics in TU Dublin. We want to hear from you, so do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_RTE. Well, for the first time in 9 months, we're opening with a positive story on COVID because, of course, the vaccine has landed. Or at least it's landed in Northern Ireland. It may be some weeks before we'll be up rolling up our sleeves here to get the vaccine on this side of the border. But plans are being drawn up for what will be an unprecedented operation, rolling out millions of double doses of vaccine in order of priority. So is the plan fair and will we be able to pull it off? John Downing, will we be able to pull this one off?
Well, we hope so. As a race of people, we have many fine qualities, but I fear organising and ordering our own affairs is not very high on that list of accomplishments. And history teaches us that we haven't always been so good at doing these things. All that being said, I think everybody hopes that it will work out. Phased announcement today on who will be entitled, and we all wait on Professor Brian McCrath's programme and proposals, which we hope to see on Friday via Cabinet. I suppose doubt and a little bit of anxiousness, but great hope, I think, by everybody across the country, because if we're going to come to get any protection, but be some form of some semblance of normality and community life, it's going to have to be via the vaccine.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think a lot of us felt that those pictures from the nurse in Northern Ireland who got it, that extraordinary 90-year-old woman, Maggie, who we are telling everyone is Irish, we're clear, from Inniskillen. There was that sense of the end of the beginning now, where, you know, with the positivity. But it's such a huge job, isn't it, Lisa Chambers, that we're taking on here? And is there a sense that we're a little bit behind the curve in terms of our arrangements and the centres, where it's going to happen, how it's going to happen?
I don't think so. I mean, we're waiting obviously for the European Medicines Agency to give approval to the vaccine before we can start the rollout. But in preparation for that happening, which is going to happen by the end of December, we see now the list of priority in terms of how it'll be rolled out, healthcare workers and those in nursing homes first, people with underlying conditions, and then it'll go down by age. So people in their 70s, 60s, 50s and so on. So that plan is in place. We've taken delivery of quite a number of high-tech, low-temperature refrigerators to store the vaccines, and there's a task force in place, and Professor Brian McCrath, who will report on Friday with that plan. So I think we're doing all the right things and we're getting ready.
This is an issue I saw being debated online yesterday. Are we able to import the vaccine so that the minute we get the thumbs up, we can roll it out the next day? Or do we have to hold off and then have that time lag again for the importation of the vaccine? Do you know this?
I see your point. I mean, I think that the difference there would be quite minor. There are plans in place to airlift the vaccine in if needs be. They're even looking at bypassing the land bridge in case Brexit goes badly so that we can get it direct into the country from mainland Europe. So plans are in place for all eventualities to get it here as quickly as possible. So our biggest challenge will be getting enough of it as quickly as we can. And then I think rolling it out, I think we're in pretty good shape actually in terms of the plan that's been put in place. We have a few weeks yet to get that ready, and we'll await the presentation on Friday to Cabinet to see what comes out of that.
Yeah, Breed, would you be confident that we have all our ducks in a row here?
Well, I suppose the first thing to say is that it's fantastic that there's a breakthrough in it. And I actually agree that I'm happy that the European Medicines Agency are checking, double checking on the raw data. I think that's important, not just because we need to be sure that the vaccine is safe, but we need to be able to reassure many doubters. It's very important that we bring people with us and educate them and reassure them. And the one worry I do have is about the role, how they're going to actually do this, right? So if you look at the public health doctors and one of the complaints they had about their role in society, we know that they voted for industrial action over numerous issues, not just their contract, but also about the role that they have in administering public health. The first thing they did say to us was that we have no national immunology database and we really need that. Now, I'm sure there's plenty of techie people could set that up.
Yeah, but so we really explain that to me, because obviously any of us who's taken our children to be vaccinated, you get the little card and put a sticker in it to say that you've got your whatever diphtheria or whatever the 3-in-1 or the 5-in-1. There's no actual database with that holds that information.
That's my belief. The no national immunology database. Now there might be an individual clinic where you've brought your child might have their own database, but there's nothing collectivised for the whole nation. And we have to administer this vaccine to every citizen, not once but twice.
Yeah. Mm.
So there are worries about it, and I think we should listen to our public health doctors, and not just rely on outsourcing these big projects like we outsource the tracking and tracing to Ernst & Young. We need to trust our public health doctors and their advice much, much more. And I do think they're undervalued and under-respected.
Well, they could be on strike when this thing is being rolled out.
And they could be on strike.
Hopefully
they won't have to do that, that their contracts and their discussions will progress. But we need to listen to them, and they have a lot to say about it.
I'll bring in Claire. Claire, there's a lot of discussion today about that list, because that's all we have, you know, firm that we can hang on to now in terms of how this will happen and where the various cohorts were placed on that list. Dermot O'Leary from the NBRU was out saying, you know, his members are obviously right on the coal face, have been right the way through this, and questioning why they're not higher up in priority. But the other one was the medical, people with medical vulnerabilities, younger people, not the people in the older cohorts that are high up on the list. I have a tweet here from Orla Tinsley. She's saying medical vulnerability is not determined by age. Why are the most medically vulnerable people under 64 at number 7 on the list for the vaccine? Saying this is someone with no immune system and CF who does not see anyone outside of their own household. And she says, not sure why I am so surprised. That did, I mean, even before I saw that tweet, that did strike me that younger people who are, you know, absolutely have locked themselves away, really, because they might have young families, they have huge people depending on them, they cannot get sick. And yet they are being told they have to wait beyond all these other groups of people before they'll be given the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, my heart goes out to somebody in that situation, because they've had a really tough year, more than the average person. You know, they really have had a really difficult year. I suppose from what my reading of it, and again, I'm not involved in these discussions, it's that they're looking at the level of risk and how much a person can protect themselves. So say for a frontline worker, they have to go to work to protect all of us. So they can't minimise their risk any more than they're already doing. So I think they're basing it on risk. And as difficult it is to keep your distance and stay home, at least you can minimise the risk more by taking those actions. So I think they're looking at it on the basis of risk and how much you can, I suppose, minimise that risk. But look, if it needs to be tweaked, that can happen. This is the initial plan. And I think government will be flexible and listen to people if tweaking is needed.
Yeah, Claire, sorry, I was trying to bring you in there. Have you seen this list? Have you any sense of where the tweaks should perhaps be considered?
Yeah, well, firstly, as others have said, it is really welcome, and it's great to be speaking in positive terms in relation to COVID after such a long and difficult almost year for so many people. And I think while this is all positive and we're talking about hope and everything else, I think it's important as well that we also remind people, you know, that COVID isn't gone. We haven't got the vaccine yet, and people do need to continue following the guidelines. And of the list that was produced today, that's welcome, and it's great that we have that. But I think that needs to be kept under review. I know the NBRU have been out and they've voiced concerns, but I think if we can resource this properly, I mean, really what we'd be looking at is how quickly we get through that list of priorities. I mean, can the first two groups be done almost together? And I mean, that will come back to the resources, making sure we have proper preparation, and that means proper staffing levels, proper consultation with our GPs, their pharmacies, and make sure that we can roll this out as well as possible. And I think the other part of that as well is while we're rolling this out, we also need to roll out measures to educate people in relation to this. People have questions, and that's natural, and those questions should be put to the GPs, to the medical experts, and we need to make sure that we bring people with us in relation to this. It is critical.
Well, I tell you now, we're just getting our texts in here. Studio, where is the oppositional voice to this on your show? Where are the real journalists to question this dubious vaccine agenda? This is going to be a very a big issue in terms of, as you said there, Bree, there's going to be people have questions. People are right because they're being presented with a vaccine, having been told for months and months that, you know, developing vaccines and getting them through all their protocols generally takes between 5 and 10 years. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, by magic, they have a vaccine in 9 months.
Well, you see, it's not by magic. I think there's a reasonable explanation as to why we have it so quickly.
No, I'm not suggesting it's magic, but I'm saying you can imagine how people might perceive the speed of this.
We have a big job of work, all of us, as you know, community representatives, to lead the way on this and to reassure people. The reason it's happened so quickly is because every country in the world came together. Governments put billions into developing this vaccine, and every pharmaceutical company that had the ability to work on this did that because it was a global issue. Has there been a vaccine of that nature in the last number of decades? Probably not. That's why it happened so quickly, and there's new technologies there as well. So I'm reassured. Certainly I'm a long way down the pecking order in getting it, but as soon as it's available, I'll be lining up. And I think political leaders, influencers, sports stars, whoever has influence with people will need to come out and be part of the pro-vaccine campaign, because the anti-vax campaign has already started. The reason the HSE haven't moved on this already is because they wanted to wait until the vaccine was cleared, they had all of the data, and they could answer every question put to them. So when they have that, they will move and the campaign will start, and we're all going to be part of that.
Just on that issue though, there was a couple of polls there in the last number of weeks, Claire, that suggested that when they broke down responses to the question, will you take the vaccine when it is offered, that Sinn Féin supporters were the least enthusiastic about the prospect of taking the vaccine. It was at like as low as 65%.
55% actually.
Yeah, I think 65% of the poll I saw. Was there another one?
I saw 55, yeah.
So Claire, what's that about?
Yeah, I think it was 55% if I recall correctly, but look, I think it's really important when we're talking about the vaccine that we're positive. There will be a cohort of the population, political parties aside, who will have questions. And that's natural. It's the first time in many of our lifetimes we've ever come against this. It will be a mass vaccination. And I think it's really important that we all have a responsibility, media, public representatives and everybody else, to promote this. My party leader has been out. We launched our plan on COVID last week. She will get the vaccine. I will get the vaccine as soon as it's available. And not just for me and for my health. I will get it, but I will get it for my family, for my nanny, to make sure I am responsible and I protect those around me.
But are you interrogating that issue within the party? Why are so many of your supporters so reluctant or expressing reluctance at this point
to
take this vaccine?
Absolutely. We will be very public in our support for this vaccine. As I've said, Mary Lou MacDonald has been out. She will take the vaccine. We will take the vaccine. And that is really, really important. And I really don't think we should be bringing political parties into this. It's not politics. There are people out there. There is a whole cohort of our population who will have questions, and that is natural. And those questions need to be answered. We need to make sure we educate people properly and we bring people together. And I and my party won't be found wanting in relation to that.
I think there is something to be delved down into it. Our supporters were 68% in favour of taking the vaccine, which means 32% aren't. And I think you have to look at the
did
mistrust.
Did that surprise you, that figure yourselves?
Yeah, I was surprised by it. But I think you have to look at the mistrust that exists of Big Pharma and the role that they have played traditionally in pushing up the price of drugs. Look at all the campaigns we've had, at least since I've become a TD, to try and get availability of medicine needed for children with very painful diseases and very painful abnormalities, cancer treatment drugs. And all of the Big Pharma companies are holding on to their own patients. And intellectual property rights is a big issue. So there's a mistrust of Big Pharma. They've rushed to this. They see companies like Pfizer potentially making massive profit out of this. And we have to be able to ensure that that doesn't happen. We can't allow patents to be hidden or intellectual property rights to be to the fore. In this situation, we have to convince people that it's a bit like the polio vaccine in the 1950s. I went to school with girls who suffered from polio, not many of them, but we could have all had polio, you know, in the 60s and stuff, had we not had that immunisation programme.
Yeah, I want to bring in John Downing.
Yeah. About the role of vaccines.
I just want to bring in John Downing because he's
at a slight disadvantage not being in the room with us here. John, just that poll, I think, surprised a lot of people when it broke down the likelihood of various supports of various parties to embrace this vaccine.
Yeah, but I think, as Breed Smith has said there, the issue is trust. It's trust, yes, certainly in the pharmaceutical companies, which is a bit of a ropey proposition given the history of it. It's also trust in the institutions, trust in the HSE, for example, and various difficulties and controversies we've had in recent times. And in fairness to both Sinn Féin and People Before Profit, they attract and speak to a constituency of people who are dissatisfied with the established structures in many cases, and it wouldn't be entirely surprising by Breed Smith's guesstimate there. It's one in three of her party, her sector's support. Claire Curran, they're saying it's almost half. So there's a huge job, and it also shows. I mean, the global figure in the Business Post poll was that basically 8 out of 10 people would have it, which is just a bit above the requirement for herd immunity, so-called herd immunity. But there's quite a job to be done here in addressing the issue of trust. And it's clear that trust will be fragile, and every step taken by the authorities will have to be very measured and very careful.
And I suppose that just the whole tone of the pro-vax campaign will be important. I'm just looking at a text we have in here from Catherine. The issue of trust is what's worrying a lot of people on this. Our government department sanctioned and issued hand sanitizer and sanitizing products that were not safe. So we did have that issue. But not only that, they held off telling the public when the alarm was raised. Our politicians are pushing this vaccine that's been okayed so fast, but the long-term effects are not known, and that takes time, and time has not been given. There are lots of questions to be answered, but if we ask them, we are seen as anti-vaccine. And I suppose there is that issue. We have another tweet here. A pro-vax campaign led by celebrities and politicians will probably backfire. Just let the medics and scientists lead it.
Well, I mean, Elvis Presley was rolled out to get the polio vaccine up and going, and that worked. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't dismiss it. I mean, I think different age groups, different cohorts, people trust different people. And maybe it's not the politicians that they trust, but maybe their local footballer or musician might be somebody that they do trust.
But there's no point. Some politicians have an approach of sort of beating you over the head with it and shoving it down your throat. There's no point in doing that. People are not stupid, and they do need to learn and to know. And I've heard some politicians talk about it as if you have to have the high moral ground on this. That won't work with the Irish people. And thankfully, it doesn't work with them, because it shows that they have a certain independence of thought, and they do need to be educated and, as I said, brought along with us. The problem is we've no alternative to it. If we could say, right, go home and drink vitamin C for the next 10 months and it won't happen, we don't have an alternative to us. And it is such a cruel and indiscriminate virus, I was trying to call it an indiscriminate vaccine, indiscriminate virus, that the only way to deal with it is to find a vaccination. Okay, well, and this seems to be the best that science has come up with.
Let me just, before we leave this, after having begun this conversation on a positive note, bring us right back down, because the Irish Times has been reporting in the last hour that the CMO, Tony Holohan's latest letter to the government has set out an ominous picture. It's telling us that as case numbers did not fall far enough after the last lockdown, they are already rising again, and Christmas is approaching with all the potentially risky socialising that entails. As a result, NPHET is already revising its modelling forecast upwards. Previously, it had forecast up to 1,200 cases a day by mid-January. Now, Dr. Holohan is predicting that this will be a reality by the second week of the month. Mm-hmm. That's pretty sobering, Lisa.
I'm not a bit surprised. That's the price that we will have to pay for opening up. I think we knew
Is that price right?
Well, I think the public wanted a bit of flexibility and a break from lockdown. It was a long 6 weeks. It was a very difficult 6 weeks. And right across the board, from just businesses to citizens, everybody wanted a break and a reprieve and to have some sort of a normal Christmas. But I think the vast majority of people realised that the virus is still in the community, and that the minute you open up, it's the numbers go up. It's happened before. So really what we need to do is get this vaccine out as quick as we can. And that's why the CMO and the Minister for Health, before we opened up, they said, please, personal responsibility, you know, keep your number of contacts to the absolute minimum for the Christmas period, and do all the things we've been doing for the last almost year.
Okay, we'll leave it there. I think we all know what we should be doing, and let's hope most of us will do that. I want to move on and touch on Brexit, because obviously we've come to this very pivotal moment. Boris Johnson off to Brussels tomorrow to hold crisis talks with Ursula von der Leyen in this last bid to broker a trade agreement. And this, of course, comes after the UK and the EU reached agreement in principle on how to implement that most contentious issue around the Northern Ireland Protocol in the withdrawal agreement. John Downing, you know how Brussels works. You spent long enough there. Call it for me. Are we going to have a trade deal this week?
More likely a deal than not. But still, I mean, for every day, I think, yes, there should be a deal. And every day there are other indicators which raise doubt. Today was a very helpful day. We saw the impediment, Michael Gove and the EU Commissioner, Vice President, agreeing to a structure which means that the Northern Ireland Protocol will work. The threats of legislation which would break the withdrawal agreement, which is only came into force on the 1st of February last, they have been withdrawn. They were seen as that threat from London was seen as a very big obstacle. That's a help. But we're still left with the 3 points: fair trade rules, a mechanism to resolve future disputes, and fisheries. And the three of those cut right to the heart of, firstly, why the UK wants to leave the EU, and secondly, why the EU wants to defend a community of nations that has taken 62 years to build up. So we're right at the fundamental point. And really, unless Boris Johnson compromises, and I know he will get help from Brussels to help him sell that those compromises, but if he doesn't, it's a very poor lookout.
Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, today is positive in that we've found a way to implement the withdrawal agreement.
And that does give an indication that they really do want a deal, because there was some speculation over the last couple of weeks around whether there really was, how badly Boris Johnson really wanted the deal. This does indicate that they are willing to move.
I don't know. I mean, there's a bit of chatter that there was pressure from the US to roll back on the infringing,
because they're of course right now trying to start their negotiations on the US trade agreement.
Correct. And obviously Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, Congressman Neal have been very clear that there'll be no trade deal if they breach the Good Friday Agreement.
Okay, so you think they could have just done that for the
well, I don't
for
know.
The Americans?
Like, I mean, the withdrawal agreement was agreed a year ago, so we've only just gotten back to where we were a year ago. Basically, that was an agreement that the UK entered into eyes wide open. They knew what they were signing up to, and then they tried to roll back on that. So now we've gotten them back off the cliff and back to the table.
But did they gain anything from that? Because obviously, reputationally, they took a big hit internationally for that.
Yeah.
What they have now, is that any better than?
It's just stressed up in a different way. I mean, I think the damage that they've done to their own international reputation with the internal markets bill and the taxation bill, where they openly admitted, a sovereign government openly admitting they were breaching international law intentionally, is remarkable. But the UK, I mean, would have been kind of a beacon of the rule of law and order. And so I think they've done damage. Yeah. The withdrawal agreement, though, is not the free trade agreement.
Yeah, OK, yeah. Go back to the free trade agreement. You sounded like you were about to tell me you're not that optimistic.
It's not that I'm not optimistic, because the sense and logic would tell you surely a deal has to get done, because on top of the pandemic, a no deal Brexit is just unthinkable. It would just devastate the UK economy. It would do serious harm to us and to other EU economies as well. Not all the same. We would be the worst hit. So it is just unthinkable. But certainly Boris Johnson seems to have lined it up in such a way that, yes, I want a deal, but if it doesn't happen, it's the EU's fault. And he's doing all the right things. But also he's saying, I won't sell out the fisheries because it's been done previously and I won't be the guy to do it a second time.
And if he doesn't sell out the fisheries, it'll be no deal.
Well, what they're proposing is quite ridiculous, actually, that they want to take out the pelagic stocks, which is basically all of the mackerel, all the valuable fish, which is 80% of the stuff that we catch there. They want to take that out of Brexit, pop it into an informal annual discussion with other island nations and decide on it year by year. I mean, the EU will never agree to that, and they know that. So how do you roll back off that? And then level playing field provisions. As John was saying, the very reason that they left is because they don't want to be bound by EU rules. But to get access to the market for free, you have to play by the rules. So how do you bridge the gap? I mean, those gaps have been there for the past year. They haven't really...
Well, yes, if you look at it from Boris Johnson's perspective, from the UK's perspective,
yeah,
this is what the whole thing was about. This is absolutely what the whole project was about asserting sovereignty and they're being asked to take some sort of a lukewarm version of that.
The British people were sold a pup. They were told basically that if we exit the EU, things will be better. But really, there's nothing better than actually being a member of the club. That's where all the benefits are.
I think there's another aspect to it. It's not just about the British asserting sovereignty. What Boris Johnson wants is a bargain basement Brexit, which basically means he can undermine standards in environment, in workers' rights, in conditions, and privatise the NHS, for example. He'd love to do all
now, of
this.
Of course, they insist that they have no intention of doing this, but
well,
they just don't
they
want
insist,
to be told they can't do it. Isn't that
they want to be put? They want to put themselves ahead as a competitive economy against Europe and to put themselves ahead by pushing down workers' rights. At the end of the day, this is going to hurt the British working class more than anybody else, and they'll have Boris Johnson to thank for it, because their rights and their services and the ability to control environmental regulations will be damaged.
It will, yeah.
Because that's what he wants, is bargain-based and Brexit.
Okay, cast forward. In two scenarios, even if we get a deal at this stage, it's going to be a very basic deal, a thin deal, you could call it, which will have to be, obviously, there'll be loads of elements that'll have to be tacked on and worked on down the line. But from here, if we get a very basic deal, and also if we don't get a deal, what will our ports, what will Rosslare and Dublin Port and Cork look like on January 1st?
I would expect there to be disruption. I mean, I think even with a deal, things will change. Change is coming. This is the end of the road. There will be no extensions because the legal basis isn't there to extend this. That timeline has passed. So there is extra paperwork. I expect there to be queues. There will be a traffic management plan in place around Dublin Port. But Dover, we have no control over. Exporters here are still using, and importers are still using the land bridge. On a positive side to that, there are new direct access routes from Rosslare and from Cork as well, straight to mainland Europe. So I think you might have an initial period of disruption. Hopefully,
so you say disruption, but I mean, are we talking like...
You don't know, Katie.
...mile back queues?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we are as prepared as we can be for this. But because there's going to be a changeover, not everybody is going to be ready to go day one. Now, in saying that, you know, in around 95% of importers and exporters are registered with their EOR or I number. So they're aware of it, they're ready, and they know the change is coming. So I think we're as good as we can be. But Dover is going to be a big problem for us. And the change to direct routes hasn't really happened yet. The capacity is there, but the demand hasn't followed it yet. I think it will take a number of months for things to settle and for the industry to adapt and move with the new changes.
Claire, quickly before we leave this, what's your sense of where we're heading now?
Yeah, well, I know people are probably sick of hearing this and we've heard it so many times, but I mean, we really are at the end of the road now, and it is going to take compromise. I mean, Boris Johnson can't have everything, and, you know, time is running out. We are, and even the Taoiseach outlined this today during Taoiseach's questions, and we'd raised it with him even today. And I mean, he has said how serious we really are in a very serious situation. And I think that we will not see the real implications of Brexit until we are past this point. We still haven't seen what those implications will be. And I think deal or no deal, it's not going to be good for Ireland in any way, shape or form.
OK, we're going to leave that there, because we will obviously be back on this tomorrow night when we'll know what happened at that lunch between Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen tomorrow. But we'll leave that there. We'll take a break. And coming up after this, we'll have Kevin Cunningham.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, we're introducing a new feature on Late Debate, where we take a breather from the debate to delve a little deeper into political moments and matters. It could be that election or that scandal or that moment of madness that we're still talking about. So do let us know if you have a political event or moment that you would like to hear dissected and discussed in this slot. Tonight, we're all about something that all of us political anoraks can't get enough of, and that is polling. How it started, its triumphs, its failures, where it's at now. And to discuss that, we have Kevin Cunningham, political lecturer in TU Dublin and MD of the polling company Ireland Thinks. Kevin, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Kate.
Before we get into the history of this, just give us, what are the polls telling us right now of the state of the parties here?
Yeah, so over the past 2 months, there have been six opinion polls. And just in terms of the bigger three parties, because I think they're the more interesting, really, because the smaller parties are only really bobbing around. But the big three parties...
Well, you're going to have to make apologies to Breed Smith now.
Sorry,
as you go.
Yeah.
As you...
Fine Gael are on 33 on average across those polls, Sinn Féin on 29 and Fianna Fáil 15. But if you take into account that in any given period some opinion polling companies are operating and some aren't, and there are differences between, particularly around Fianna Fáil, some have Fianna Fáil relatively higher and some have them much lower. So if you're to try to weight and kind of average that out to know that, you know, some polling companies are better and worse for different parties, then it would put Sinn Féin at 29.5 and slightly ahead of Fine Gael on 29 and Fianna Fáil up at 17.5. So they're really neck and neck, the two bigger parties, with Fianna Fáil a third party. When we look at this in terms of a general election, because I think that's always the important thing to do, those figures which suggest, you know, Sinn Féin would get 50 seats, Fine Gael would get 49, and Fianna Fáil 28.
Wow.
What is interesting about that is, I think if you go into another election, the clear questions are, the presumption has to be that one of those two larger parties would lead the next government. And then the questions are on all the other parties of how do they resolve that issue? How do they navigate what is essentially a kind of an increased polarisation within the public?
Yeah, but of course, all that presumes that the polls are right.
Yeah.
And that is a very big bone of contention within the polling world, is it not? No, before we go there.
Okay. Yeah.
with the hard questions. Yeah. Take me back to the beginning of polling.
Okay.
Where did it start?
So, yeah, it started, I mean, it was really in the United States. And it's funny how, you know, when the 2020 election was being covered, we were all glued on the numbers. And that's really where it's all originated, in the 19th century, where newspapers locally in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, still swing states today, were conducting local polls and straw polls of people in their local areas. That's how it started, until one magazine in particular, the Literary Digest, started to do this on a national scale. And what they were doing was, they identified phone books and big books of members' association to try and get as many addresses of people they could possible. And they would send letters out to all these people, partly to try to boost their readership, let's be honest, right? But they would do that repeatedly, and they got the election right 5 times in a row in doing this. And they were very successful, in fact.
So they literally just wrote to random people, that they harvested these addresses and asked them to write back and
about
say who
they were going to vote. And then they just counted them as they came back. And this worked for a while. And remember, the world and countries have become less homogenous. There's, you know, different groups of people in society, and they act quite differently. This kind of started to, quite famously, and it led to the total collapse of the Literary Digest itself, one of the biggest magazines in the United States, when in one election they mailed out 10 million people and got 2.3 million returns. It was the 1932 general election. And this is really the interesting one in terms of polling, in that they had 2.3 million people. They thought there was going to be a landslide for a candidate called Alf Landon, and instead it was actually Teddy Roosevelt who won. What happened at the same time was, there was a small polling company, which we now know is a big polling company, called Gallup, by a guy called George Gallup, who had a much smaller sample, but based his method on what we think of now as a, you know, representative sample. He basically had quotas. He said, OK, I'm going to make sure that I have this certain amount of men, certain amount of women, certain amount of people age under 40, over 40, and so on. And he successfully predicted the Teddy Roosevelt election. And that was... that was a big thing in polling. So it was a movement towards, right, we need to focus more, not just on how many people were asking the question, but actually...
the type of people we asked.
Yeah,
and how do we get to that number? Because we see in all, most reputable polls, it's about 1,000. That's what's considered the figure that from which we can extrapolate what the whole country thinks.
Yeah, so that comes from sampling theory and statistics, and you know, statistics that would involve measuring anything. Of when you get to 1,000, it's called the normal distribution, where you're the central limit theorem, where when you get to a certain number of people, the numbers gravitate towards the national figure or whatever, and you only need about 1,000 to get an estimate of plus or minus 3% on a national poll. Now, that kind of plus or minus 3% is only part of the source of error. Essentially, when you're conducting an opinion poll, there's a number of different things that can go wrong. First, we have to assume that the people that we ask are representative of the people as a whole. The second bit is we want to make sure that those that respond are reflective of the broader public.
So the thing you'd see here then is, say, if you are still conducting a poll the old-fashioned way by ringing people's landlines, you are then excluding a lot of people who now no longer have landlines and only use their mobile.
Precisely. Yeah. And in fact, just as an aside, that's one of the issues why state-level polling in the United States is relatively weak, because they have to rely on landlines, because they don't know the mobile numbers of people residing in an individual state, because mobile numbers are on a national level. You know, we know that here. Obviously.
Oh, they're not. Yeah, they're not geographically.
So they have to rely on quite a lot more landlines, basically.
And what do we do here?
So we different polling companies do a mix of landline and mobile numbers, but obviously mobile numbers, every 08, some whatever number, will find an Irish person on the other end. So you kind of have a bit more to play with from that perspective.
Go on.
I was just going to say, the next bit in that, like, there's this series of different errors. The next bit is obviously whether people are going to
tell you the truth,
tell you the right thing, right? And then the last bit is whether what they tell you is what they're going to actually do. The tell you the right thing is notoriously the shy Tory or shy Brexit or whatever. There doesn't seem to be much evidence for this, which might surprise people, but this has been something that polling companies and research agencies have looked into in great detail, and there isn't really that level of difference, especially with the kind of new online polling where there isn't really someone facing you at the other end for which you might think that you need to give an appropriate answer.
Speaking of not giving appropriate answers, apparently it was FDR, not Teddy Roosevelt, that won against Landon.
Sorry,
according
to the Teddy Roosevelt
Brian
one
in the
was,
bus. Yes, anyway.
A different one, yeah.
I just to stop the text coming in on that one. Okay, so things can go wrong with polls, obviously, and they have spectacularly in some recent polls. I think we have a clip of the announcement in the early hours of the morning of the Brexit vote from this is David Dembleby.
Well, at 20 minutes to five, we can now say the decision taken in 1975 by this country to join the common market has been reversed by this referendum to leave the EU. We are absolutely clear now that there is no way that the Remain side can win. It looks as though the gap's going to be something like 52-48, so a 4-point lead.
Even now, 4 years on, it's still quite a shocking announcement. But it was especially shocking that night because we were not expecting that. And in the same way as we were not expecting the Trump win. Yeah. And we were not expecting the last Tory victory to the degree.
Yeah, there's two features of the Brexit one in particular. In the first case, the difference between the polls and the result was slightly narrower for the online polling companies, which had sculpted basically subsets of the electorate that they thought were representative. So the difference was slightly narrower there. And that's what led to a lot of British polling companies to just ditch the telephone polling in particular. But the margin of error on that particular one was around 4%. Now, there was a study done by Will Jennings and Chris Valesian looking at 350 elections, historically speaking, to try to understand to what extent had polls got better or worse over time. To what extent is this a reality? What they found was that the polls have actually got slightly better over time.
Really?
Which might surprise people. Yeah, so it's only slightly, but it's a very narrowly better. One thing when you look at that data, though, is that the errors are bigger, naturally, because I mentioned these other sources of error, than that kind of plus or minus 3%. Effectively, for all intents and purposes, the plus or minus 3% is actually about plus or minus 4.3%. So it's actually a little bit bigger. So 95% of the time, the polls are getting it within plus or minus 4.3. And remember,
but that is actually, in reality, can be quite a big margin. It can.
Yeah, and in an American election.
So is it the interpretation of polls that is actually leading us astray to some degree, rather than the actual numbers?
There is some of that. I mean, if you remember, there was never really any reaction to the marriage equality referendum. So in that particular referendum, the result was, as expected, a landslide in favour of the yes vote. But the polls are out by about 9% on average there. And the polls in the Brexit referendum were out by about 4%, which is about average for where polls are typically out. One of the things about the Trump one was that we were relying on state-level polls, and those state-level polls aren't very good. And it's in very specific areas that he did relatively well. Whereas if you look at the national-level polling in the United States, it was pretty much bang on. And in fact, on this occasion, the exit poll in the US had Biden 4.3 ahead, and he's now 4.5% ahead. Mm-hmm. So those polls aren't very far off.
Okay, and I'm just conscious I could talk for another hour about this, but I can't. Before we leave it, are polls dangerous in some ways, politically, to democracy, I mean, in terms of possibly... hang on, I'll ask Lisa this, because she's nodding right now. Do you believe polls can shift... votes basically ahead of an election?
I do, and I'd actually be in favour of banning the publication of polls, maybe even in the 2 weeks prior to polling. I think they are sometimes self-fulfilling prophecies. People like to back a winner. If you're told the person or the party you're backing is on the slide, sometimes it can actually, accelerate that downfall and
well, it can also galvanise support.
It can, but it shouldn't do anything like that. It shouldn't influence the electoral process. So my point is that I think it does, and that's just anecdotally from talking to people, on campaign teams. When you're in the middle of an election, it does have an impact, and we do devour them during that period. I think there should be a free space before polling, whatever that would be. I'm just suggesting 2 weeks, but I do think they do impact the electoral process, and I don't think they shouldn't. I think they shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, clearly obviously all TDs are programmed to say, when we ask about a poll, when their party is looking poor in a poll, that, it's just a snapshot. The only poll you're interested in is the one on election day. But they do have a major impact on morale in parties and on, I assume, even policies, because parties respond to these polls.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think it goes without saying, when you're doing well in a poll, it's good, and it brings good momentum. People are positive, and I think there's no doubt about that. But I don't know how much the ordinary Joe Soap really reads into polls, even at election time. I mean, parties can be doing well nationally. It might not be reflected in individual constituencies, and I'm not sure how much people necessarily read into them, and particularly at times like this, when we're perhaps so far out, or supposedly so far out from an election, perhaps nearer to the time it does. But I'm just not sure how much people on the ground read into polls in general.
Kevin, last word.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of banning polls before the election, I have to say I wouldn't agree. But in general, I think there is a bandwagon.
You are
effect.
A polling company, yeah, so
well,
come on.
I just to be clear, like I'm very critical of public opinion polling, and have been so in Britain in particular, because there's a dynamic here which is slightly different to what happens in Britain, where in some countries there's an argument that politicians are quite out of touch with what the general public feel, and politicians are quite limited in terms of how much they can hear about the general public. In other circumstances, I think Britain has gone the other way. In fact, they're responding too much to opinion polling and not reflecting the fact that they are representatives that are there to actually make decisions themselves. So they're being led by the polls a little bit too much. Here, I would argue, in some respect, the politicians are sometimes a little bit out of touch, in that it took quite a long time for, say, the Eighth Amendment to be passed, even though the opinion polls quite clearly showed for quite a long time that there was support for this. So I think in some respect, politicians need opinion polling to get an understanding of the general public, because...
And journalists need them to fill programmes like this and newspaper
but
columns.
Could I just say something there,
yeah,
Katie? I'm sympathetic to what what Lisa had to say about the idea of a moratorium on publication of polls is what I would put, rather than banning them, in the same way as the broadcast moratorium, yeah, to allow people a bit of silence to reflect. But I don't see how it can be done in the modern era. It used to be done in France for years, and Michael Noonan proposed legislation on this almost 20 years ago, the series of by-elections in Tipperary, South Tipperary, and it turned out to be completely impossible. But in the era of social media, that information is going to go around. There is no way of stopping that.
And then, of course, there is the infamous private poll that is leaked at a very opportune moment in the last week or two of an election, giving one or other candidate.
I think it's worth adding that most polls, like, I didn't do one within the final 2 weeks anyway. So I don't think the polling companies are looking for that. But okay. I think there is an argument to be had about, like, what is its relevance within politics and how much it kind of over-influence things.
OK, we'll no doubt have those arguments again, but I'm going to have to leave that one there and take a break. But stay with us, because we have still have much to discuss before the top of the hour.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And that was really interesting take on polling there from Kevin. We have sanitised the seat again and Breed is back with us. One trend that is indisputable in the polls is the drift, as Kevin described there, towards Sinn Féin and Fine Gael, and at the expense of Fianna Fáil. And this is very much reflected then in the open warfare between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael, in particular online. But Sinn Féin has not had a great week, Claire. Just to recap, Brian Stanley is now on a week's break from his Oireachtas duties to be with his family by order of Mary Lou MacDonald. That is since the rolling controversies about various tweets by Brian Stanley, which has also triggered a number of young party activists to resign from the party. Can we go back to the very beginning of this briefly, Claire? Because I'm just conscious you're the youngest Sinn Féin representative in the Oireachtas. And you would have been 2 years old when the IRA ceasefire was declared in 94. Am I right with that, my sums?
Yeah.
And I just go back to that first tweet, the Brian Stanley tweet that caused the initial controversy. Kilmichael, 1920, and Narrowwater, 1979, the two IRA operations that taught the elite of the British Army and the establishment the cost of occupying Ireland. Pity for everyone, they were such slow learners. How does that sit with you, as somebody who wasn't around for that campaign of violence? And this is now all these years later.
Yeah, firstly, just to say Brian Stanley has taken a week out. He's not used to being in the political storm he's been in for the last week, nor is his family. And there's no such thing as that being by order of Mary Lou. They met, they had a discussion. And I mean, Mary Lou has a responsibility to our well-being.
Didn't Mary Lou not say she told him to take a week out
with
his family?
No, it wasn't by order. It was a discussion. And it was as much benefit to Brian and his family as anything else. And that's really important. In relation to The first tweet, which of course Brian removed and immediately apologised for, he went before the Public Accounts Committee. He made a very genuine and wholesome apology and statement. He listened to other members and he responded to them and engaged with them, and that was important. Do you know, I never feel in any ways comfortable or even like I can talk about all of these things that often come up, particularly come up at election time. I wasn't born. It is, you know, for my generation, it wasn't part of our lives. We grew up in peace, and we grew up in peace, thankfully, because of people like Brian who pushed that agenda for peace on our island. And I'm very grateful that isn't the IRA, or that's not a choice for me, because we have grown up in peace, and that is something that we have to protect. And I think these kind of conversations serve nobody. And I'm also very mindful, and I never comment on these kind of things because I don't want to add to the grief on both sides. And it's important to say it was both sides. I don't condone violence at all. And there was hurt and there was suffering on both sides.
But the reason I put it to you in that way, though, Claire Caram, is just because, you know, a lot of people would see you as representing the people who now support Sinn Féin that weren't around for any of that, that joined Sinn Féin and support Sinn Féin for different reasons. And I just wonder how it sits with you and how it would sit with them.
I mean,
does it jar with your sense of what Sinn Féin should be about now?
No, it doesn't, because at the same time, I mean, I understand why the IRA was there. I understand why people joined the IRA. I understand what happened on our island and what happened in the north. And I understand the discrimination, the horrific events that took place, the absolute discrimination, the way that people...
That's why I think a lot of people are confused about the response from the party to this particular tweet, because... You know, a lot of people really believe this was the Sinn Féin story, basically, that there is this direct line between the War of Independence to the Provisional IRA's campaign, and that in both cases, in Kilmichael and in Arrowater, the people who died were legitimate targets. Is that not the accepted line for Sinn Féin support and Sinn Féin members?
It probably is for some, but I mean,
is it for you?
No, I'm look, a totally different generation. As I said, I just find it difficult to comment on these kind of things that happened way, 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 I mean, 30 years before I was born. You know, we are in a new generation now, and we're in a peace process now for 20 years. And that's something that we have to protect. And I think it serves nobody. That's why Brian apologised. That's why the tweet was removed. He did the right thing in apologising. And, you know, I'm about the future and leading a peaceful future that we very much need to protect. And that's what I want to be part of. And I think the rest serves nobody. A history is important, and that's fine. But we need to, we move forward and we try on this road to build a united Ireland for all our people and reunite our country. And that's something I want to be part of.
Lisa.
There's a lot of aspects to this. I think Brian Stanley being sent home for a week in the hope that this dies down over the next week and that he can't say anything else to inflame the situation is probably more like what's happened. The hypocrisy of it, the Sinn Féin members, members of the organisation, they're online activists. On a daily basis, abuse and torment people. I've been the subject of it on numerous occasions.
So have I, and from other parties.
I didn't interrupt you, Claire, so I'll have my say. So the suggestion that somehow Brian needs some time out because it's getting a bit too hot and heavy, he has to answer for those tweets. It's not just the Narrowater tweet. It's the one about Leo Varadkar saying that he can do what you like in bed but don't look for a pay rise the next morning. To me, that has homophobic connotations to it. And then recently learning that a young female member of the party had somebody call to her door, her home house, to tell her remove an offending tweet that was criticising the Sinn Féin party. And Mary Lou MacDonald's response to that was, the common structure, everyone knows everybody, that's quite normal. Fianna Fáil is a common structure. We have done since the party was organised. Nobody in our party would ever call to your house telling you to remove a tweet because they didn't like the sound of it. That's beyond now
would
normal.
Would you be quite relaxed about somebody calling to your home and asking you to remove a tweet?
If it was me, and I know that Christine has made this point in relation to somebody making a call or sending an email as perhaps a preference, and that's probably something that I would do in relation to picking up the phone or dropping an email. But if the person happened to live three doors down, I'm the local organiser, I've been in and out of the house for 30 years, I probably wouldn't think.
But Christine O'Mahony didn't feel that was
appropriate. Yeah, and that's fair enough. And that was absolutely 100%. And I know people have apologised, and I know the local organisation have apologised to her. But I think these kind of comments to suggest that, you know, the heavies went around, you know, I think that's rubbish. And I don't think people should be trying to suggest.
Well, to be fair, Christine, happened. I don't think Christine ever suggested it was
no,
the heavies
she
either.
She didn't, but others.
It was
have.
A senior, she's somebody she regards as a senior figure within Meath,
yes, the local organiser, yeah, and a neighbour and a family friend, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the word that jumped out at me throughout this whole discussion is Lisa's use of the word hypocrisy. I mean, Fianna Fáil were a party that were born in the armed struggle, and De Valera, who founded it, was a revolutionary fighter in his day. And yet Fianna Fáil are one of the parties who over the last decades have refused to stop Shannon being used as a military base for American troops on their way to Iraq, bombing whatever amount of innocent civilians in Afghanistan or Iraq. And they didn't seem to stop.
What you're saying is there's plenty of hypocrisy to go around here.
Stinking of hypocrisy.
We just have John. Are you? Do we still have John?
You do indeed. Yeah.
Okay. We only have. I only have 20 seconds for you, John. But Brian Stanley's back in to make his statement in the Dáil next week. Will that draw a line under it, do you think?
I don't think it's going to draw a line under it. It'll be very interesting to see what the members of, and from memory, Breed is one. Members of the, no, sorry, I've got that wrong. Members of the PAC, what view they take of this. There are 13 of them. And I think if they are prepared to continue with Brian Stanley, then he may persist. If not, well, there are big questions. Meanwhile, we have been looking at weeks and weeks of what amounts to a Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, Punch and Judy show. And I think that's definitely going to continue.
Well, I think, yes. I think we'll go back. We will return to this for sure. But we're actually over time now, so I have to let that go. We'd never got to the pay rise story. We may return to that tomorrow. The front page of the Examiner, Cabinet reverses pension cuts for Taoiseach. That's it for us tonight. The programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and Mark Dwyer was on sound. And now, a little late, with apologies, it's over to Colin Murray on Late Date.